Judge Johnson, Judge Reyes, Judge Cochran. The Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Please be seated.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. For the sake of the audio record, I will say that today's date is January 6, 2022. This panel of the court today has four cases on its calendar, three of which will be submitted by oral argument. Two of those three were scheduled ultimately to be heard in the courtroom here, and the third case is scheduled to be argued via Zoom after the first two cases in the courtroom. So the first case on today's calendar is number A21-668, Nicholas Pankook versus State of Minnesota. Counsel for respondent is present. Counsel for appellant is not present. We have had staff of the Court of Appeals has had contact with appellant's counsel, who says that he was at his computer terminal waiting for the Zoom oral argument. We have asked him to come to the courthouse as soon as possible. That means that respondent's counsel, I guess, would need to wait. Is that something that you can do, given your plans and schedule for the day?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you. It's my understanding that counsel for the second case are both present. I don't see. There's Mr. Sheridan. There he is, and Mr. Pesch is here in the gallery. So, Mr. Sheridan, if you're ready to proceed, we will take the second case first, because we don't have both counsel for our first case. So we'll do a little bit of rearranging. We will hear oral argument in the second case first. If Mr. Wilson is here at the conclusion of that argument, we will, or soon thereafter, we'll do the first case then. But we have a scheduled time to do the third case by Zoom. I'm speaking now to Mr. Bees or Mr. St. Martin. I'm not sure of your name, but so we'll address that again after we're done with the first case. So are both counsel in the second case ready to proceed? If you are, I'll call the case. Mr. Pesch, you're in. Okay, thank you. All right. The court will now hear oral argument in case number A21-751, Joseph Lawrence Weber versus the Commissioner of Public Safety. As both of you well know, you have 15 minutes for your principal argument, and appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for rebuttal. I think the rules, I think the notice that you received, and I believe the Chief Justice's order, says that counsel may choose to wear a mask or not wear a mask at your discretion. For whatever it's worth, I think it's the plan of each of the three judges to keep our mask on throughout the arguments. And if you can't understand the question, please ask us to repeat. I'll let you know, we are experimenting with an item in the center of the courtroom. It's called an owl, I guess. It is a way of perhaps capturing video and audio from the middle of the courtroom. It's just an experiment today to be viewed only by internal court staff, but I'm just letting you know that that's what it's there for. Very good. Counsel for appellant, you may introduce yourself and begin your argument.
Thank you, Your Honors. And I should say that I'm hoping not to run out of breath. If I do, I will remove the mask, but I'm going to do my best to keep it on for everybody's safety. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Jeffrey Sheridan. I am the attorney for the appellant in this case. His name is Joseph Weber. By coincidence, I also happen to have been the counsel of record for the case of Fedzik versus Commissioner of Public Safety and Bendorf versus Commissioner of Public Safety, which are two cases that will probably feature prominently in, I'm sure, our lively debate here today. And I apologize, I'm already running out of breath.
Yep, at your discretion.
My N95 works great, unless you want to breathe. There are two issues before the court today. The first having to do with our fundamental disagreement with the commissioner about the meaning of Fedzik, or I suppose from their point of view, whether Fedzik has any meaning at all. And the second is whether, in the face of uncontroverted evidence, that the officer in this case used an impermissible measurement for determining whether or not to terminate a person's right to counsel, the constitutional right to counsel, whether the district court erred in upholding that revocation in any event. The first issue has to do with our motion for summary judgment that was brought before the trial court. The facts are not disputed. The matter was filed in a timely fashion. Mr. Weber fulfilled his obligation under the statute to make a challenge within the statute of limitations. He did so. And after the filing, there was simply no response whatsoever from the court. The court, well, I take that back. There was a notice that the case had been filed, but then no action was taken with regard to scheduling the matter for a hearing. After a period of time.
And could I stop you there, Mr. Sheridan?
Sure.
I mean, am I correct in surmising that that was not the established policy and practice of the court before the pandemic, but that it was perhaps an anomaly arising from the pandemic?
Anomalous to this case or anomalous to that courthouse?
Well, that's part of my question, I think.
Okay.
And I guess, and maybe my question also is, was Mr. Weber's case handled differently from other cases, even at that courthouse at that time, or was there just a general slowdown or stoppage of processing of these types of cases?
Your Honor, and again, this is anecdotal and outside the record, but my understanding is that the Washington County Courthouse essentially went dark, that no one heard anything from the Washington County Courthouse for quite some time. I can't remember if I had another implied consent case in that courthouse during that initial phase of the pandemic, so I can't really provide you with firsthand knowledge. But just through the grapevine that no one heard from Washington County during the initial stages of the pandemic.
Sounds like, as far as the record reveals, simply there was no hearing and no hearing was scheduled for Mr. Weber, and that's all we know.
Correct. And so there was the filing of the motion for summary judgment, and I'll say that even after the filing of the motion for summary judgment in April, the matter still didn't, and for the reasons set forth in the motion for summary judgment that we had been heard nothing but crickets from the courthouse. Still nothing was scheduled until November of that year. So from April to November, even with the motion pending, no action was taken during that time period either. And so the question then becomes, what does Fedzik mean? Whose job is it to ensure that a person's due process rights were vindicated in this case? There's no question that Mr. Weber served out his entire license revocation before this case was ever scheduled, before anything in this case was ever scheduled, right? So when we brought the Fedzik declaratory judgment action, it was about the fact that the government had basically allowed this practice of pre-hearing license revocation to continue without the procedures necessary to ensure that due process were observed. And the holding, in my view, of the Fedzik decision is the court struck it down and said, if you want to wield this power, and make no mistake, this is a singularly un-American thing to take property first and ask questions later, right? So the lack of a prior hearing is an extremely rare thing in this nation. And what the Fedzik decision was about is that if you intend to wield that kind of power, government of the state of Minnesota, you have obligations to ensure that the people whose property you're taking, that their due process rights are protected. And again, the counsel for the commissioner is asking you to now reweigh everything that the Supreme Court weighed in Fedzik in arriving at the conclusion that the absence of a speedy hearing is fatal to the process of pre-hearing license revocation. They ask you to perform this Mackey versus Montrum balancing test, but the Supreme Court already did that. And
counsel, in Fedzik, the court held that the 2003 version of the statute violated due process.
Correct.
Reviving the prior version of the statute, correct?
Correct, yes.
And the version of the statute that was in effect when Mr. Weber received the revocation is different than the statute that was in effect in Fedzik.
That's certainly correct. And that's why we're not asking you to find that what happened to Mr. Weber was unconstitutional, that the statute is unconstitutional on its face. That's what the challenge was in Fedzik. It is that it is that is unconstitutional as applied to him, because one of the requirements, one of the things that was reinstated after Fedzik, was the requirement that the court administrator establish procedures to ensure compliance, timely compliance with the requirement that the matter be heard not later than 60 days after the filing. So all of that got put back into the statute. And because it did not take place here, that the court administrator did not establish a procedure that would ensure compliance, and in fact, there was no procedure and no compliance, that's why Mr. Weber's due process rights were violated in this instance. But
did
not
Mr.
that this
Weber,
it's unconstitutional on its face.
Well, help me understand why we wouldn't apply the Matthews factors and why we wouldn't consider whether Mr. Weber requested a stay
because,
after the 60 days.
Sure. Because under Fedzik, the Minnesota Supreme Court has already decided that pre-hearing license revocation in the absence of speedy review is a due process violation. Under Berry versus Barchi, we remember that Matthews and Mackey versus Montrum and Berry versus Barchi were decided on the same day, and that the Mackey versus I'm going to get those wrong. Mackey and Matthews, same principle. Was a hotly contested, divided case on the question of how the balancing came out. But there were no dissenters at all in Berry versus Barchi, where the sole question is, did Barchi get a hearing in a timely fashion? Was there a process in place to give him a hearing? And in that case, they talked about a hearing that would take place before the end of before he had served out his entire suspension. His suspension was 15 days. That's how quick they were talking about you needed to get a hearing, because, as they pointed out in Berry versus Barchi, once the suspension is in place, it is the suspended person's interest that becomes paramount. The interest in a speedy hearing becomes paramount. That's why you don't engage in the balancing test. The Supreme Court already did that when the lack of a speedy hearing was missing, and said that it was fatal, that the lack of a speedy hearing was fatal to the statute, and struck it down.
But if this is an as-applied challenge, then isn't it a different analysis with respect to prejudice? And I'm wondering whether we might not ask, I think it's the second part of the Matthews test, ask about the risk of an erroneous deprivation. I mean, I think, which is, a general, thinking of the whole population, but if it's an as-applied challenge, wouldn't we just simply look at this case and decide whether Mr. Weber's deprivation was erroneous, in which case I suppose we'd look at Section 2 of your brief.
And go back to Berry versus Barchi. So what happened here is that there was a pre-hearing revocation And the state actors went, just continued to proceed with situation as normal, at least the state actors in Washington County, situation as normal, and didn't give them a hearing, right? The question here is where does the onus belong? What Fedzik makes clear is that the onus is on the entity who wishes to wield the power of pre-hearing license revocation. Right. If you're going to do that, you have the burden to make sure that you're protecting the rights of the people that you're taking property from without a prior.
Maybe my question, if I may just finish. I think my question is there a constitutional violation if there was no hearing provided throughout the revocation period, but after all is said and done, we can see in hindsight that it was not a wrongful deprivation because there was no apparent basis. You know, let's say if you lose on Roman 2 in your brief, part 2 of your brief, then we know that there was no that the deprivation actually wasn't wrongful because he had no valid basis for revoking it. And so doesn't that sort of an intervening fact that prevents a constitutional violation, or is the mere fact of not having a hearing in itself a constitutional injury that leads to a violation?
Which is why I separated it out into two pieces, right? The court's like, well, why don't we just, you can argue this at the end of your case. And I'm like, no, the violation is complete today, and why we're doing it is a motion for summary judgment. Before we knew that the other court was going to uphold the revocation in the end, you cannot, what's the procedure your decision would come up with? Is that we should first do the hearing and then decide whether or not it should have happened in a timely fashion. I don't think you get to separate that out. And what we're looking at is that in the moment that Judge Ilka decided that he was going to deny the motion for summary judgment, he didn't know the outcome of the, he didn't know any of the facts of the ultimate hearing, which is why there are two very separate and distinct violations here, either one of which should have resulted in a rescission of the license revocation.
Good morning, Mr. Sheridan. Morning. First of all, it's good to see you in person.
It's nice to be seen in person, I think.
I have several questions for you, but sure. I want to try to address some of the points that you raised. And one of them is, it seems that you're arguing an issue that's already been decided by Mackey in terms of using the Matthews test, which is a balancing test. It seems like you're just focusing on one who has a burden, but the Matthews test is a three-part balancing test, and that's the first comment. Second comment is, it seems like that's been reinforced by Hedden, and third, to Judge Cochran's point, since that time there have been a number of changes and procedures that have been provided to defendants to allow them, you can ask for, the ignition switch.
Oh, the ignition
interlock. So that people can drive. Okay. But more importantly is the issue that I want to get to is you can ask for a stay of that revocation. And why, when you look at the case law subsequent to this, why isn't a stay, it seems like it's almost invited error for a defendant to not ask for that and then later complain that his rights have been violated.
Okay. So, and I'll try to get to all of those here in the brief time I have left.
And I realize time is short, so actually the last one is the one I'd like you to focus on.
Sure. Well, first of all, the Mackey versus Montrum, if you're going down that path, you're allowing the losing party in Fedzik to relitigate that case. They did the balancing and then said, despite all of that, under Berry versus Barchi, the absence of a speedy hearing is fatal to this case. This is not about rebalancing that. It's not about relitigating what the Supreme Court already decided, because what they decided is that regardless of the balancing test in Mackey versus Montrum, under Berry versus Barchi, the absence of a speedy hearing is fatal to pre-hearing license
but
revocation.
But that part that you're talking about, it being fatal, I don't think case law bears that out. It's not mandatory. It's so.
But each one of those cases, and what you're talking about then is Bendorf and whatnot. In each one of those cases, through whatever processes were in place, those people both stood in front. So Bendorf and Rehm,
both stood in front of the court having either A, been offered by a state actor in Rheem, right? The onus was on the court to come up with a procedure to ensure compliance.
Is that mandatory, though? You say the onus is on the court. Is it mandatory that the court offer the defendant the opportunity to have a stay?
The onus is on the government because the government is the one who wants to wield the power of pre-hearing license revocation. That's why the onus is on the government, the state actors, the commissioner, right? The options were there, right? Once they appreciated that implied consent hearings weren't going to happen, the commissioners could have just said, stop revoking licenses. We'll wait until people are convicted and we'll get our revocations then. So they had the power to intervene and stop the pre-hearing license revocation, or to do as the first judicial district did, and that is to say, look, we're not going to get these things heard, so the moment you file them, we're going to reinstate everybody's driver's license, the same way, by the way, that they did in Rheem. So it was the state actor who took the step of offering the reinstatement, and the driver turned it down in Rheem. In Bendorf, he got his license back. And so in the absence then of the prejudice, that's what they looked at then at that. But in the Rheem case, they said you prejudiced yourself. And in the Bendorf case, they said you have no prejudice. So that factually, these are so distinct from what's happened here. And again, it was a problem that could have been solved by the entity that wanted to wield the enormous power of pre-hearing taking of property. And it is that party that you must look at and decide, did they take the steps necessary to protect the due process rights of the individual? And I've long ago run out of time, and right. It's like flashing at me now.
Well, I want to allow enough time for the Judge Reyes's questions to be answered. And if do you have any more questions?
I do not. Okay. Thank you, Judge Johnson.
Okay.
Thank you,
Mr. Sheridan. Counsel for respondent, you may approach and introduce yourself and your clients and then begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Ryan Pesch, and I represent the respondent, Commissioner of Public Safety, in this matter. I'd like to begin by noting that although appellant states throughout his brief that he's challenging this law as applied, all of his arguments essentially are challenging the law on its face. So none of the arguments that are made in this case are arguments that are unique to his situation. They're the same arguments that we would see any time a hearing is held outside of 60 days. And I think for that reason, some of the court's questions are pointed in the fact that they go to what makes this case concerning from a due process perspective. And to Judge Reyes's question, I think that one of the determinative factors in this case is that there was hardship relief available and appellant didn't take advantage of it. So to the extent that he's now claiming he was somehow prejudiced by the delay, I think misses the point of what it means to have a violation of due process. I think here due process was sufficiently protected by the safeguards in place. The statute specifically contemplates that a hearing will not be held within 60 days on every occasion. It gives the court the power to issue a stay if a stay is requested, but there are many reasons why people don't request stays. Some people acknowledge the fact that they're likely going to be serving a revocation, and they might rather serve that revocation during a pandemic, for example, when very few people are driving and they may not need their driver's license. So the
Counsel,
idea that...
I'd like to discuss the hardship question with you a little bit. Now, under the statute, you can request a stay if the hearing hasn't been conducted within 60 days. Is there any case that establishes that there isn't hardship resulting from a revocation of 60 days? In other words, it under the statute, it allows revocation for up to 60 days, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
You can't get a stay before the 60 days under the statute as written. Would you agree with that?
I don't agree that you can't receive a stay before 60 days because we see stays granted before 60 days have elapsed.
Well, that's true, but what language of the statute would allow for a stay prior to the 60 days?
Well, I think that the statute gives the court discretion to grant a stay if the hearing will not be held within 60 days. So to the extent that a judge may be in a position to see that that hearing is not scheduled within 60 days and cannot be scheduled within 60 days, I don't think that the statute limits a district court's power to grant that stay before 60 days has elapsed. I think that the statute gives a little bit of discretion to the district court in that regard.
Well, I'm not sure that's exactly the way the language reads, but in any event, is there any case that discusses whether the stay period automatically doesn't result in a hardship? Because the statute says the reviewing court may order a stay of the balance of the revocation or disqualification if the hearing has not been conducted within 60 days after the filing of the petition upon the terms the court deems proper. So in terms of hardship, it seems to presume that you don't get a stay until the 60th day. Maybe I'm not reading that correctly, but let's assume that's the case. Is there any case that discusses the hardship in terms of this language and that there it concludes that there isn't a hardship if the license remains revoked within those first 60 days?
Are you asking whether there's a hardship if the hearing is held within, like, on the 59th day? What sort of hardship there
is? No, I'm asking, is there any case, let's assume there isn't a hearing within the 60 days, and then on the 61st day, someone requests a stay. Is there any case that analyzes the due process question, or maybe and then they later argue due process was violated because their license was revoked for the full 60 days, even if they were granted a stay on the 61st day, that there was a hardship because they couldn't drive those first 60 days. Is there any case that analyzes the hardship question from that perspective?
I believe respondent would be relying on Bendorf and Rehm for the...
But in Rehm, I think the defendant was offered a stay immediately, right?
That's correct. And did not take advantage of that stay.
I mean, here, there wasn't a request for a stay, so we're in a little different situation. But I guess, you know, in terms of analyzing the hardship, I'm wondering, why isn't there a hardship if someone can't drive for 60 days? And maybe there's other, you know, avenues available that means that hardship won't occur because you can get a limited license or participate in the ignition lock program, as Judge Reyes mentioned, but I'm just trying to get at why this statute doesn't result in a hardship.
Well, Your Honor, I think the hardship relief factor of Matthews has a lot of elements to it. So to boil it down to whether or not a 60-day deadline is a per se violation, I think misses the point of what it means to be a balancing test. And in Minnesota, as you've pointed out, we do have the ignition interlock program. We have the availability of a stay. There's limited licenses that are available if people need to drive for their employment. And I think the hardship relief factor, as courts have analyzed it, takes into account all of those situations and avenues to get relief. So I'm not aware of a case that specifically confronts the idea that someone requesting a stay on the 61st day has suffered 60 days of hardship. I think that in general, courts look to whether or not, as a whole, there was prejudice that resulted, and because of the hardship relief that's available, if someone didn't request that stay during the 60 days, I think that the burden is on the driver. It's a benefit that's conferred by the statute. The burden is on the driver to protect that benefit. I think
Mr. Pesch. Good morning to you, and good to see you in person as well again. I want to follow up on that point, though. Why is the burden on the petitioner? Why isn't the burden on the state? Because the state is the one who's going to be depriving the person of those rights. And even when you look at the Rehm case, they have been notified, which is a fact that's different from what we have here. yes, those remedies are available, but why is the burden on the petitioner?
Well, Your Honor, I think that since we're discussing an as-applied challenge here, I think that in this case, we don't necessarily have to reach the broader question of, is it always the driver's burden to request a stay? If it was a pro se party, I might have a different response, but here, Mr. Weber was represented by counsel. That counsel knew that a stay is a remedy that's frequently requested. That counsel knew the way to go about requesting a stay if they had wanted a stay. So the idea that counsel for appellant could sit for 60 days, not request a stay, I think it was shortly after 60 days, file a motion for summary judgment on this FEDSIC issue, I think kind of illustrates the fact that they weren't actually focused on this hardship relief. They were more focused on how to maybe get a rescission from the district court, and the idea that that was an avenue that could be sought is a little troubling, and I think that it kind of belies the hardship relief factor as applied to this specific case.
You would agree that this case is maybe one step beyond Rheem, because in Rheem the district court offered it, made it fairly effortless for the petitioner to take advantage of the stay. In this case, it required an affirmative motion by the petitioner, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. I acknowledge that there was no standing order or some communication from the court to the appellant before the 60 days that would have affirmatively indicated that a stay was available. However, I would again point out that there's nothing to show that appellant wasn't aware of stay was available, and in fact, his representation would indicate to the contrary.
And just to confirm, I mean, there's no case law from this court or the Supreme Court with that fact saying that the availability of a motion to stay is equivalent to the availability of, you know, accepting the offer of a stay. I mean, in other words, this fact pattern has not presented itself before to our courts?
I don't think that this specific fact pattern has, but I don't think that the language in Rheem is so narrow as to require the court to reach out in advance. I think that the language in Rheem specifically says it is the availability of a stay and doesn't mention the fact that there was a policy in place. So to the extent that these facts are different, I agree, but I don't think that that moves this case outside of the precedent that Rheem set.
Mr. Pesch, the district court did note the options available, stay, limited license, as well as interlock system. But what case law indicates that, I'm coming back to the burden issue, that burden is on the defendant or petitioner to request those? And if the burden is on them, is there a subsequent notice requirement that the state notify the person of any or all of those options that may be available?
I'm not aware of any requirement that the district court or respondent notify someone of their remedies. I think that in general, that requirement doesn't exist, and because we're again talking about an as-applied challenge, in this case, there's no contention that appellant had the knowledge of all of those different remedies. So, to the extent that the ignition interlock system maybe wasn't affirmatively offered, I don't think changes the analysis. If there are no more questions from the panel, I would yield the rest of my time and rely on my brief, just asking the court to affirm the district court's denial of summary judgment and affirm on the issue of right to counsel. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pesch. Mr. Sheridan, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. Your Honors, what Fedzik said is that this idea of a speedy hearing isn't a statutory right, it's a constitutional right, and it is a necessary right. So the balancing was done in Fedzik, and it came out in favor of the state. The Fedzik case said that we're not going to revisit all of our prior decisions saying that this process is constitutional. The only thing that changed was the speedy hearing. That one thing was the pivot of Fedzik and required the court to strike the entire statute down as unconstitutional. That the balancing is done. The state wins, right? You look at Hedden versus Dirkswager, you look at Davis, you look at the other ones that were cited there by Fedzik, is that the state wins in a pure balancing test, except if you take away the speedy hearing and then it all dies. Right, so that's what Fedzik stands for. And in the face of Fedzik, in the face of that decision, when we were confronted with a pandemic, the state actors said, we don't need to do anything. The commissioner didn't do a thing. The court didn't do a thing. So if you're asking who's the burden on, the burden is actually found in the revived statute. Because the revived statute says the petitioner has a burden, and that is he's got to file a lawsuit within 60 days, pay his $300 filing fee, and file a lawsuit within 60 days. And then the petitioner's burden is complete. The next burden is in the statute itself. The district court administrator shall establish procedures to make sure that the speedy hearing requirement is addressed. The state actor, the court administrator, the court, however you want to fashion that out, didn't do its job. And the other state actor, knowing that these were not getting scheduled for hearings, in, at least in Washington County, did nothing about it too. So, and that's what the summary judgment order says, is that, well, we didn't need to do anything. The onus was on you. That's incorrect. The onus on the driver is to file a timely petition, and they are entitled to due process of law once they have done that. They have to pay for it, and he did everything he needed to do. He asked for that revocation to be reviewed by a court. And all of the rules that apply to that happening in a constitutional fashion applied to him, except they were denied here. And in that denial, his due process rights were violated, counsel, just as Ms. Fedzik's were.
If the court had given your client notice that on the 60th, if a hearing wasn't held by the 60th day, he could request a stay, would that have been
Or just state it.
Would that have been sufficient? Would you not be here today on the due process?
Well, we'd be having a very different argument, absolutely.
And
absolutely.
You'd still be arguing the right to counsel issue, but...
Correct. But the court basically forgave itself for doing nothing, which is what the court did, was nothing, except send out a notice saying, yep, we know you filed your case, and then did nothing. The onus is on the entity that wishes to wield this enormous power, that is the state of Minnesota. And the state of Minnesota failed to protect my client's due process rights in this instance. You don't have to go beyond that.
Would you agree, though, that the law makes clear that you can request a stay if the hearing isn't held within 60 days, and generally your individuals are charged with knowledge of the law?
I don't think it says that he can request a stay. It says that the revocation can be stayed.
It says the reviewing court may order a stay. So
correct.
Is there anything that precludes a request of a stay?
Oh, there's nothing that precludes a request of a stay. Yeah. Okay. Other than now we file another $75 motion fee to say, hey, court that was supposed to do this on your own because Fedzik said it was your burden, hey, wake up. You didn't do anything. So now I get to spend another $75 and file a motion, and who knows when that motion might be heard. And again, the remedy is not a guarantee. It's still discretionary. It doesn't even have to be granted.
The district court also did note, though, the opportunity to get a limited license or...
Which is all part of that balancing that took place in Hedden and all of those other things where the state wins, and I agree. The one thing that the state loses on is when they don't provide the speedy hearing. That's what Fedzik says. That's what Berry versus Barchi says, right? That's a unanimous decision issued on the same day as they fought about this balancing. The same day they were unanimous in saying, oh yeah, but if there's not a speedy hearing, you're dead in the water, which is exactly what Fedzik said. And in the face of that, the state actors did nothing when this pandemic struck, except ignore the due process rights of people who filed lawfully and timely filed their challenges in that courthouse. And that is fatal to this case for the commissioner, not for me. So I see that I am again getting the flashing red light. I will take the hint and bid you adieu.
Thank you, Mr. Sheridan. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case is submitted, and the court will issue its written opinion within 90 days.